Bill Friedman was so gracious here. You stay in an extra 30 minutes for us to handle all these calls that keep rolling in as we talk about Las Vegas. So we're going to do that. And then 30 minutes from now, open lines begin on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Bill Friedman. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Let's go back to the calls. Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Michael, thank you for holding, sir.
And thank you for this wonderful conversation, George. Nobody does it like you.
Thank you, sir.
George, Bill Friedman, I've got to say something to you. It's going to be hard for you to take this. But I'm going to ask that George invite you back 2 weeks from tonight to respond to what I'm about to say, because you're going to need time to think about it and do a little research. You said that Mo Dalitz blew up in your face like nobody you've ever seen do, and I'm going to tell you why he did that. He did it, and I'm going to give you the facts and where you can get them, where you can find them, to verify everything that I'm going to tell you.
Okay, fire away.
He did that because Mo Dalitz was involved in of John F. Kennedy. And we know that because your buddy, Gianni Russo, Frank Sinatra's buddy, who used to collect $1,000 per seat at the table that that Frank set aside for Gianni Russo, that's G-I-A-N-N-I, The Godfather of Hollywood is the title of his book. He played in the great movie, The Godfather. But and when he spoke to George Knapp on this program, it was either January of last year or the year before, I forget. But when he spoke from Frank Costello's apartment, which had been left to him. Now, what he explained here on Coast to Coast, and here's, I'm going to give you my challenge after I just make this other statement. My challenge for you coming back in 2 weeks. What he said on Coast to Coast during that interview with George Knapp was that he himself, as Frank Costello's main delivery man, delivered letters to all the heads of the mafia to get their approval for the hit on John F. Kennedy. Now, here's why I'm calling. Because I am very, very close to former FBI and CIA agents who want this matter finally cleared up. And this is your opportunity to come before this audience and tell them whether or not Gianni Russo is telling the truth or is all full of it.
Well, that's pretty strong there, Bill. What do you think of that challenge?
Who is Gianni Russo?
Michael, you still there? Well, he hung up. Gianni Russo, I guess his name, right? Bill, are you there?
Yeah, I don't know who he's talking about.
Somebody named Gianni Russo? You don't know him?
I know of the name Russo, but I don't know what he had to do with any of these people. I mean, I just...
Okay. Well, Michael, maybe you can send us more.
I can't connect him to the industry. He may have written a book, but...
You're baffled.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're dealing with something that happened in 1963, and I just don't see any ties to what was discussed.
Okay, I think we'll pull some old information about it, because he was a guest, I think, about 2 years ago. He was an author, and he made some allegations. Let's go to Andy in California. Andy, go ahead.
Hi, George. You're a great patriot. Really have a great show tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest, what does he know about Sam Momo Giancana and his connection to Vegas? And also, as you probably know, he shared the same girlfriend as Mr.
Kennedy.
Yes, Judith Campbell Exner. And also, I can say this from an excellent source, that Mr. Giancana knew exactly what happened and the details of what happened to our Teamster boss, Jimmy Hoffa. So I'd like to get his opinion on that, and any connections to Vegas, and just how much influence did he wield?
Okay.
And by the way, he was brought over from Mexico in his robe, on a private government jet, taken by force, brought to his Frank Lloyd Wright home in Oak Park, Illinois, which I saw, a beautiful home.
That's where he got shot, right?
And he was shot with a .22. Caliber revolver, the type that they use for mob hits, and shot the day before he was being made to testify in federal court. So put that one together. Thank you.
Interesting take on that. Did you see any connection with Giancana in Vegas at all, Bill?
Oh, absolutely. That is what Mo was afraid I would find out. He was a major hidden interest in the Stardust, and that is what he didn't want me to find out.
Uh-huh.
But without them, and in other words, there was just no evidence that made sense until they gave it to me. And this caller, interestingly enough, referred to him as Momo. The only time, that may have been his name in Chicago, but the only time I ever heard that term was when I was be at the Stardust and they'd mention, well, Momo this, Momo that. That was the only time I heard the name. But he for many years was in the Stardust, and the man I was so close to, that was the convention salesman, every month took his piece down to Mexico for him.
And Momo was shot in his house while he was cooking peppers and sausage in the back of the head. He was shot in June of 1975, and Hoffa disappeared in July of 1975. And I think Giancana knew Hoffa. I'm pretty sure he did, Bill.
Yeah. The thing is, I don't see any correlation. What happened was Bobby Kennedy was determined to get three people. He went after Giancana and made him flee the country, and Giancana came back and wanted to come back to power, and he was eliminated. He got Hoffa sent to prison. Hoffa got out of prison, and he wanted to come back to power, and the new people stopped him.
Exactly.
The third person he wanted to get was Mo Dalitz, and he never got a single thing on him.
Mo, I assume, is dead now, right?
Oh, yeah. Everybody I'm writing about now is dead. I was interviewing these people back in the late 60s and early 70s. He had a major FBI thing going on against Mo, and they couldn't come up with a single thing on him.
Wasn't it Giancana who delivered Chicago to the Kennedys during the 1960 election?
Let me think before I...
I'm pretty sure he was. He was.
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to be sure before I said it.
And they did share a girlfriend. I mean, they knew each other.
See, one of the New York mobsters that I was very close to, they came to him, and begged him to do it, and he wouldn't touch it. And that's why I wanted to make sure that I have the right person in it.
I get it.
But when was that election? Yes.
1960.
Yeah, and he came to regret that when Bobby was made attorney general.
Let's go to Bill, truck driving in Utah. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Bill. Hey, George. Hey, I have a question. There's sort of a reverse conspiracy theory that nobody ever talks about anymore, that the mafia never even existed. And I did meet a guy that made a convincing argument. Okay, I'm 52, and he referred to me as a gullible kid. He said I would believe anything. He said the mafia didn't even exist. And I met a woman. She said that she lived in Vegas her whole life. And she said Vegas was a great place to live until the so-called criminal gangsters were moved out or were bought out, you know. So she kind of echoed what you were saying. And my question is this. I'm kind of curious if organized crime could ever rise again in America. And I think the truth is somewhere in between, and maybe you can shed some, you know, help me with this. I have this feeling what really bound these families together, or these individuals together, was their desire to not pay tax, or pay as low of tax on their entrepreneurship, to pay as little as possible. And with all this talk about taxes going up, raising the, and so many companies don't even pay a tax. And they, you know, like they say, Apple Computer's really an Irish company now, right? Because they don't want to pay taxes. What do you think? What do you think about my theory that really what united these interests were not wanting to pay taxes?
No, I think there were two things that made these gangs work. One, they control an area, and they had so much firepower, you better not do any crime unless you're paying them part of it. And the second thing is the gangs can't exist without having corrupt police and prosecutors and judges. And so you paid them, but you also got protected from prosecution. And those were the driving forces. And, of course, organized crime is still with us. It's just the mafia isn't as big as it used to be. But there are other nationalities that have been coming in, and they're doing their thing. And, of course, the drug trade and et cetera.
And it's not as honorable as it used to be, is it?
That was just an amazing group. You know, I won't take the time. It's in the book of how these guys came to power. They were not ambitious. They didn't want power. They didn't want to fight anybody. And they got drug into two wars, and they ended up winning them. And all of a sudden, they're on top, and they've got these different values. And they really shook the system up. But once they leave, of course, everybody does whatever they want again.
Was it Prohibition, Bill, that really got the mob going?
Yeah. Up until then, we had very tough street gangs in the poor areas. But we had nothing that you would call organized crime. It was the huge profits they could make that all of a sudden they could become big. And what's interesting is the mafia was completely Sicilian, and they stayed in their own territories because they came from a culture where they were afraid of the government. They were afraid of other people. And this group was wide open. Everybody did the prohibition in their own territory. They did the gambling in their own territory. And these guys went across the country. They dealt with everybody. They were the only three big gangs that had different nationalities in them. They took in everybody. And the irony is, and he was an awful man, don't mishear that, but Capone was the only other gang that was multinational. He took in, when he'd get in a war with someone, he didn't try to kill everyone. He tried to break the gang up. And those that wanted to join him, that was fine. And he'd let them keep working in their territories. But those were the only four gangs in the country. As different as they were, Capone, with everybody else on violence, that were multinational. Otherwise, what happens is people come to America, they go where the culture's the same, sometimes the language the same, and they understand each other, and the kids start getting into trouble.
Well, and Prohibition started in 1920. What did they come up with that idea for anyways? What were they afraid of?
Prohibition?
Yeah.
I have presented that in this book. Believe it or not, Prohibition started at the very beginning in the 1600s when America was first founded. Not America, but the colonies.
The
were
colonies.
First founded.
Yeah.
There were some colonies that that wanted a Prohibition, and I trace. In other words, it wasn't like this was there, but similar. Step by step, these groups kept building, and all the forces came together. And the government finally gave in to them, but so many people still wanted to drink, even in those who passed it, that they made sure that they didn't have enough Prohibition agents to close it down. This whole thing was a conflict between those who wanted it and those who didn't want it, and it kept seesawing, and it ended up a mess. It was just like Italians could, in their homes, as long as they didn't sell it, could make like 200 bottles of wine a year.
And so that's true, yeah.
Italian districts, you couldn't drive down the street without smelling alcohol, because the gangs, there was gangs that did nothing but supply them equipment in their bathtub and bring them all the ingredients every week and pick up the bottles. And this is how they supplemented their incomes. And if they were caught, they said, hey, I don't have 200 bottles here. I mean, it was just, when you look at this whole thing, it was a mess from beginning to end and had to end up all fouled up.
Bill, take 30 seconds and tell folks where they can get your books.
You can get the soft cover books at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble, and all of the digitized companies have the e-books available, so anybody, you can get them from.
Thank you, Bill. We'll get some information on that Gianni Russo that Michael from Virginia passed on and get it to you, and maybe you could do a little research on that and see what you come up with. Okay, as promised, in just a moment, we will have open lines. We begin open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. So those of you who are still on hold, Tom will check in with you, see if you want to stay on for open lines. If not, make the call. Fascinating discussion with Bill Friedman, wasn't it? Fantastic. Well, we're going to start open lines now, and we'll do that, of course, next hour as well. And we will end the program with a special tribute to the late Rosemary Ellen Guiley, one of the greatest paranormal writers I've ever come across. Well, welcome back to Open Lines now here on Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Great to be with you indeed. Hope all is well. Hope you are surviving this COVID situation and you get through it. If you want also to check in with us, let me know if you got the vaccine or not and if you had any symptoms or after effects after that as well. As you know, on this program, we will never tell you to get vaccines or not to. This is your situation. This is your business. What we try to do is present facts and stuff. So with some of the interviews, as you know, Howard Bloom is a booster on vaccines. Christian Wild loves vaccines. John Curtis, he's middle of the road. I try to bring you different guests with different perspectives, but it's your decision ultimately for yourself and your family. But if you did get the vaccine and you had some kind of reaction to it or not, let us know how that went too. But let's go to the phones. Folks have been holding for a while. Let's start by going to Brendan in Austin, Texas, east of the Rockies. Hello, Brendan.
Hello. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
George, I had a question for you. Also a story from my family that I wanted to share real quickly. I think everybody
sure.
would like. But my question is, did Richard C. Hoagland ever mention cattle mutilations?
I know,
that?
I know Linda Moulton Howe did quite a lot, Brendan, and she even wrote a book on that. She called The Strange Harvest. I can't recall in the years I've interviewed Richard if he talked about cattle mutilations. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't think so.
Yeah, because that would be really interesting with the whole Nazi space program angle that he had.
Exactly. He talked a lot about the face, as you know, on Cydonia and Mars, but I don't recall him talking about cattle mutilations. And he didn't get into a lot of UFO stories at that time. He was more specifically about anomalies and strange things like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll get into my story real quick, and we'll let other people get on. Okay. So this story is from my great grandfather. And he was a truck driver, and he shared one of his stories with me. And he did truck driving for all sorts of places and for people. And one of them was delivering argon to White Sands Missile Range in the 70s.
Okay.
And he told me about a energy weapon that he got to see that they were using. You know, this is like 50 years ago. And it was a big semi-stationary machine. And this is what he told me once again, is that an officer came out holding a briefcase and that it had an optic in it. And that when he put this optic, and that's what they called it, into the machine, and it would only work with this piece that the officer would bring, and they would fire it, and they would call it controlled lightning. And I don't know if it was a laser or a lightning or what, but that's just kind of what he was like. Maybe that was a layman's term for it. Or
what year might that have been, Brendan? What do you think?
I have no idea. I just know that it was in the 70s.
Wow. 48,
yeah, so
50 years ago.
What was that?
48 or 50 years ago. That's amazing.
Yeah. So the officer continued on and said that they were firing it into the mountain because they may have accidentally shot down a U-2 spy plane by firing it into the air.
Wow.
And that the reason they were firing it into the mountain was because, and they were firing it through a 12-inch thick piece of steel, and it kept on going into the mountain, and they would go and they were measuring it, how far into the mountain it would go. And there is actually a U-2 spy plane that has gone missing around that time.
It was flown by a guy named Gary Powers that went down over the Soviet Union at the time, and they held him. But I don't think that was the one they knocked down. It could have been something else.
I don't think that was the same one. But, yeah, I just wanted to share that story. And right now he has Alzheimer's, and his name's Mickey. If anybody wants to pray for him, I would really appreciate it.
You got it, Brenda. He's on the prayer list as of right now.
Yeah, just to surround him with angels, you know. And thank you, guys, and I always appreciate it with y'all on Coast to Coast. Y'all help a lot of people out, and thanks to all the listeners, too.
Thank you, Brenda. Appreciate it. What a great story. They had some kind of particle beam weaponry back in 1970. I think they probably did, and God knows what they have it now. And you heard the story I had last night, something strange happening at the White House where some people have been getting strangely ill. They think they're being bombarded by something like happened in our embassy in Havana. Let's go to Mike the Millennial in Denver, Colorado. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, George. How are you?
I'm great. I hope you are, too.
I'm doing outstanding. You know, first of all, I don't get to do this as often as I'd like. I'd like to thank all the Coast to Coast AM staff, the community, all my friends I've met through Coast to Coast, you know, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, everyone responsible for making this show what it is, and you, of course, George, you're the kind of the glue that holds it all together. So just thank you so much, really.
Oh, you're welcome. And, you know, thank you for being the kind of listener you are. And I've got to tell you something, Mike. You know, to a lot of folks who may not know it, we met you at our Beyond Belief shooting in Denver a couple months ago, and you brought your mother with you. We've got all kinds of ages on this program, from listeners who are young to listeners who are pretty old. And it runs the gamut. And you are 24, 25 years old, if I recall.
I'm 25, yeah.
And, 25. I mean, if the rest of our listeners your age are like you, I'm not worried about the future of our country, because I see folks like you as being the backbone of the United States. You're smart, you're intelligent, and you're caring, you're kind. And I want to thank you for being one of our listeners.
Well, that's a little overwhelming, and it means so much to me coming from you, George. I mean, I started listening to Coast to Coast when I was 12 years old, and obviously, it changed my life, and it's given me kind of a new outlook and a new purpose on life, and I just really appreciate it, George. And I did have a comment for Open Lines.
Sure.
Again, thank you so much, really.
You grew up with us.
I did. Yeah,
that's great.
Did. Got me through a lot of hard times, but just thank you so much. So Michael Collins, the astronaut, of course we know, passed away this past week, and he wrote a book called Carrying the Fire. And, this book was an amazing book. It talked about the 5 years leading up to the famous Apollo 11 mission. And it talked about kind of like what went into the technology at the time and what went into like the construction of how these modules were built. And also, Michael Collins, he actually was one of the only people to ever see the backside of the moon, the dark side of the moon. And when he was there, as you probably know, George, he was completely cut off from communications with NASA at the time. And, he talked about, that how obviously it was kind of nerve-wracking being that far from Earth and not having any contact.
Exactly.
With
and he's up there by himself.
Right, right. But, I know you've had the chance to interview, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, which is, I'm envious of that. But, Michael Collins, I would have loved to ask him about that, what that was like seeing the dark side of the moon.
I bet it was eerie.
Yeah.
And so silent, just going around the moon with really no sound out there.
Right.
Must have been something. Yeah, that's something. And, of course, don't forget Edgar Mitchell, great astronaut he was.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, Michael, keep in touch. Keep listening. Thank you. Next up, there's Cornelius in Louisiana. Here he is.
Hey, George, and I'd call him Mike the Miracle Man, Mike the Millennial. Him and Ruthie did so much for him. I hope Ruthie's listening. And I love my Sea Crane radio. Ruthie got me because my old MP radio cut out on me.
I got to tell Bob Crane, you're like a walking commercial for him.
George, that's like the first caller praying for his papa and everything. I need some prayers too. I haven't been feeling too well. And
you sound a little down. What's the matter?
Well, George, I'm going through a whole lot of stuff. And these home banks here, you got to hire a lawyer just to get to your stuff, this secession thing. Yet a big bank like Capital One just gave me paperwork to fill out, and I got my dad's stuff. So I'm just depressed about that. But I wanted to say something about some of the listeners and callers. A lady from, I'm not going to give her name, from Alabama wrote me and stuff and thought so much of me and stuff. But, George, without you and Tommy, I don't know what I'd do. And you got a coin, because I gave two coins. They're over 100 years old. Tommy's got them in the two caps when you get over to...
Knowing Tommy, he probably sold them for a profit somewhere.
Oh, that's good.
And didn't tell me about it, of course.
But anyway, when are you leaving for Los Angeles?
Next week.
Okay.
End of the week.
Go to National Rarities. I want you to see them four coins. I said, because those people, they love you, George, from National Rarities. There's two white fellas that come... But I needed some money then, so I just sold them. I didn't get much for them, like $65. I probably should have gotten more than that. But like I said, without my friends like Barry and Rock Hills and Martha and Wayne in Washington and who else?
Well, we're always here for you.
Well, George, and that's the one thing. Just like you can pick out things with the guests and callers, you can get a whole lot more out of them because of the way you treat them. But let me tell you a story about when I first met y'all, because this is something new. Well, I met Tommy first, and I gave him the LSU caps and stuff. And so I asked Tommy, I said, well, look, can I get up to the room and stuff? But Tommy's a good security man, too. No, I don't think you can make it up to the room. But I didn't want to do it. But he knows there may be some kind of frantic fan or something like that that may, you know, maybe.
I've had a few of those, too.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Tommy would have been a good military police officer, and everybody knows I was an MP in Anniston, Alabama at Fort McClellan. But I tell you, I got to find an MP cap for Tommy just to make him an honorary military police officer and everything. But, George, like I said, and you play my favorite song, I tell you, What a Wonderful World.
Well, listen, I want you to just perk up. We're always here for you.
Yeah, put me on the prayer list, too.
You're on the list. Okay, my friends.
All right, God bless you.
Stay well. Stay well. He's a good guy. And sounds a little down today. And let's go to you, Tom, with a text and tweet. But Corny sounds a little depressed.
He does, and he's got one of the biggest hearts in this world.
Yeah, he does. And you just let him know whatever he needs.
Yeah, I just got to say, though, really, I'm not Corny, you don't got to send coins and stuff. It's just
We don't need stuff like
Tom,
do you remember when I first started doing Coast to Coast? A great lady, she's died now,
I know
named Janie
say.
Out of Chicago, sent me a fruitcake for Christmas. And you folks know what a fruitcake is. And I open it up, and just so you know, I never eat anything that a guest sends. It's just a personal thing of mine.
No, I've it's done not. It Nobody
all,
does
I've,
that.
I've done it all my life. Don't send food and cookies. Just don't do it. And anyways, I got a fruitcake for Christmas, and I called you into the office. We opened it up, and a third of it was bitten.
Oh, God.
Bitten, not cut. Not cut, but bitten out by Janie's teeth. And
poor lady.
I don't know what we did. I think I gave you the fruitcake to get rid of.
Such a nice lady.
And then when I went in the kitchen, I think you put it on the table.
I did. We have this table in the lunchroom.
For the staff to eat.
We have this table in the lunchroom that's like the hole. You know, anything that goes in there, people take or the cleaning people throw away. So I just didn't think it was safe.
So you put it on the kitchen table for the staff.
No, the cleaning people.
But she was a kind-hearted
Thank
lady.
You, Janie, though. Your heart's in the right place.
God bless her. She's up there watching us now. Anyways, text and tweets. What do you
this
got?
One's from Mason in Phoenix, Arizona. What's the worst accident you've ever had to your body, and do you have scars?
I had an accident back around 1968. My father had given me his Mercury car to keep because he picked up a new one. He worked for Ford Motor Company and loved Ford products. And I'm in this big old Mercury car, Mercury Marquis, and I'm on the freeway, and it was kind of hilly. It's in Detroit. And I went, it was rainy. I'm coming down a little hill on the freeway doing about 60, and all the cars are stopped. All of them. And I might have about 150 feet left. I slam on the brakes, Tom, and I just hydroplane. And I'm just going, shh. I ram into the car in front, probably at about 20 miles an hour. There were no seat belts there. There were no airbags. I bounce off the steering wheel. Didn't go to the hospital, but I was so sore the next day. But let me tell you the weirdest thing about that. And if you've been in an accident, you know what I'm talking about. My nervous system fell apart about a day later. I had no control over it, but I couldn't eat. I would get sick to my stomach for a week. I was just inside. My nervous system just collapsed. And that's the only accident I've been in, knock on wood.
Well, that beats what I thought, because I actually thought you were going to say the pizza roll incident.
Well, that was horrible.
That was an accident.
That was horrible. My God, I bit into that thing. It was like molten lava. And the worst part about it is your throat starts swelling up. And I just defy anybody to not swallow voluntarily. You know how you do it involuntarily? It's just natural. If you have to think about it, it's the worst feeling in the world. You think you're suffocating.
Terrible.
It's horrible. All right, well, stick with us. We're at the top of the hour, but we're coming back for more open lines. Those of you on hold, just hang where you are, and don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, grab our YouTube channel, and also we're on TikTok now. We're having fun doing that. All of those, just go to coasttocoastam.com. They're at the top right-hand corner. And download our free app, the Coast to Coast AM app, in your app store.